Good morning, or good evening, wherever you may be, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for people with too many records, books, and DVDs, and too little time. I'm Andrew Harrison, and this week we will be looking at Kathryn Bigelow's harrowing new movie drama Detroit, which covers a single moment of extreme police brutality during the urban disorders of civil rights era America. Does it work as movie and history, and is it possible to enjoy a movie like this? And what does it say about now? We'll also be looking at the new album by Ghost Poet, the British MC and vocalist who bends hip-hop into such weird shapes that it's hard to know if what he makes is hip-hop at all. What's going on with the brilliantly titled Dark Days and Canapes? I think that title's up there with Charlotte Church's Tissues and Issues. And finally, we'll be looking at the latest Marvel series on Netflix, The Defenders. After four separate series, Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage and Danny Rand, a.k.a. Iron Fist, are coming together as the local super team for New York, a kind of Aldi Avengers. Can such a crowded TV show work, and who's the weakest link in the Defenders? And of course, we've got a special guest to help us weigh in on these weighty matters. It's summer, so we're on skeleton staff. Only one guest this week, but he's definitely up to the task. Making his Big Mouth debut, Steve Yates is a music and politics journalist, a veteran of good old The Word magazine, a longtime mentor to young magazine journalists on Live magazine. For God's sake, Steve, don't get young people into working for magazines. There's no future in it. And a man of conflicted loyalties, as both of his teams, Brighton and Liverpool FC, are now in the Premiership. Hello, Steve. Welcome to Big Mouth.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm not doing too badly, thank you.
Jolly good. Are you looking forward to Saturday, the 2nd of December, when Liverpool will visit Brighton?
Yes.
Will you be torn in two?
Nope. No, there's really no contest. That's the sort of conflict I settled about nearly 40 years ago, 38 years ago, in fact,
yes.
When Brighton first went up into the then First Division. So there's no contest.
Fair, so it's strictly Seagulls then.
It's strictly the Seagulls.
How are you finding the heady experience of the Premier League?
A little too heady at the moment. I think we're sort
you
of in the sort of falling down drunk stage at the minute, it seems. There is better to come. Our best player of last season has not played more than sort of 20 minutes a match yet, and there are big new signings on the horizon. In fact, the big new signings have been made, but dots need to be.
Brighton fans are a kind of a sophisticated cosmopolitan bunch, aren't they?
I believe
you're practically
so, yes.
In France.
We are, yes.
How are you fitting in the rough and tumble of proletarian Premier League?
Yeah, right.
As the prawn sandwiches fly. Yes.
We have Razors Hooton as our manager. We'll cope just fine.
Fantastic.
We'll cope just fine.
Okay, also with us, you heard him just then, the tactical genius who eschews a crude long ball game in favour of an aggressive strategy he calls Total Podcast. It's the inscrutable Johan Cruyff of audio, our producer, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, yeah.
Jolly good. We had an actual fantastic, proper football guest on our sister podcast, Romaniacs, last week, Philippe Auclair, did we not?
He's a lovely man.
Yes, it was very, very interesting on what Brexit is going to mean to football. Listeners, you might want to investigate the battle against Brexit at Romaniacs.com. Matt, you'll be happy to know he told me Manchester United are going to walk it this year and Liverpool have no chance whatsoever.
I'm holding my fire on that one.
Okay. Well,
the hubris has been, you know, too many seasons. The hubris is not over Liverpool spunking it after the first two games, but United winning anything after first two games is the hubris is definitely not, has been learned.
Yes, heated debate. So well, that's set an amicable tone for the show, hasn't it? Yes. Before we get started, just a friendly reminder, dear listener, if you use an Apple device, why not subscribe to Big Mouth via Apple Podcasts? You can do it on the podcast app on your phone or the iTunes Music Store. And why not give us a lovely review and a star rating too while you're there? It all helps to butter up the evil algorithms that control everything, and it helps get us in front of more listeners. We would be really grateful. Android people, don't despair. You can get us on Stitcher and Audio Boom too, as well as Spotify. So let's get cracking with the acclaimed new movie Detroit. Or is it Detroit? Detroit? I don't know. How are we saying it? Detroit. Directed by Kathryn Bigelow of the Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty fame. Set in 1967 during the civil violence that erupted after years of heavy-handed policing, Detroit covers the notorious Algiers Hotel incident. Responding to a telephone report of an active sniper, a group of police invaded the Algiers Motel and interrogated 10 unarmed black men and 2 white women with extreme violence. By the time the interrogators left, 3 men had been shot to death and all of the others, including the women, had been badly beaten. Bigelow's movie stars British actors John Boyega, Will Poulter and Hannah Murray, alongside Anthony Mackie and a host of African-American actors who might be a bit less familiar to British viewers. It contrasts extreme violence with Detroit's unparalleled music of the time, the Motown sound produced by a generation of black Americans on the move. Before we talk about the movie, let's hear one of those tracks. This is The Dramatics and All Because of You. Yeah. That was The Dramatics and All Because of You from Kathryn Bigelow's Detroit. It actually features in the movie, doesn't it, Steve? We see the band, The Dramatics, rehearsing this tune. It's a long time since I came out of a movie with my blood actually boiling. I mean, the injustice that you see in this film is incredible. What did you make of it?
Exactly the same feeling. I mean, sort of watching the court scene in the...
Be careful with the spoilers,
towards the end.
Yeah.
And we are sort of avoiding spoilers. You did sort of think there's that scene where sort of Larry Reed is sort of slightly... Who's the singer of The Dramatics, whose life is sort of permanently affected by what happens. And he's sort of being sort of slightly cheeky and funny with the lawyers when he's in the dock. Sorry, not in the dock, when he's giving his evidence. But if you do sort of... Your blood is so pumping by this stage. You do kind of think if he'd sort of pulled out a gun and shot Will Poulter's cop dead, the whole audience would have stood up and cheered. It's just an... It's an absolute gut punch of a film.
And, well, the setup is the three strands of. I mean, obviously, there's a massive amount going on in this eruption of civil violence in Detroit and across America. But the setup of this story is that there are three particular strands which converge in a single room in the Algiers Hotel on the 25th of July 1967. We see the cop you just described, Will Poulter, played by British actor Will Poulter, who's clearly got very little regard for the laws of policing. And you see him before the action commences. You see him basically go to a point of no return, which kind of informs all of his actions afterwards. We see the actual real-life band, The Dramatics, who are trying to get an audition with Motown. They head off to the Algiers to kind of chill out party. And we see John Boyega's security guard basically trying to be helpful to the National Guard. He's bringing them coffee, but he gets drawn into this torture chamber, and there's a horrendous sense of inevitability to it, isn't there?
Boyega's character is an extremely sad one, I think, isn't he? Out of sort of... Out of the whole film, he's the one who you sort of feel most pity for, even though he's not sort of one of those who dies.
Yeah.
His...
I think we can... That's all right. That's all right. It's a spoiler, isn't it?
I mean, that much of it is sort of fairly clear from the pre-publicity. He is someone who sort of desperately wants to get on, and he kind of sees... He's one of those who sort of sees both sides of it. And in this conflict, unfortunately, it feels like... As far as he's concerned, anyway, there almost is only one side.
Yeah, I mean, you see him, he's a kind of conscience figure, isn't he? He spends an awful lot of the movie simply shadowing the protagonist and looking on in horror.
Yes.
And I think it's a fantastic performance because you can see, you know, what Boyega conveys brilliantly is, am I going to do something here or am I not? And he's kind of criticised as an Uncle Tom in an earlier part of the film, and this is essentially... That's the conflict at the heart of the film, isn't it? You know, to what extent do the black characters have to just knuckle under, or are they going to stand up? And they're in an awful position where it's just impossible.
Yeah, and one of the sort of criticisms that has emerged of the film, I mean, it's inevitable now that any film, whether it deals with politics or not, is going to sort of have a load of amateur politicians sort of taking shots at it from simply because it doesn't tell exactly the story they want it to tell. But one of the criticisms that has emerged from this film is that the black characters in this film do not have any agency.
Yeah.
They're not sort of affecting what happens. They are simply the sort of passive victims of it. And he sort of sums that up in many ways, because as I say, he sort of comes out of it. He is completely unable to affect anything.
But I think that's
the worst he can do is to sort of give Poulter a talking to.
Yeah,
a very small talking to which Poulter himself happily smirks away. And
I think it's really interesting because the typical sort of conservative, small C conservative, you know, politically right responses. Well, you know, if only the black community would attempt to cooperate, if only the black community wasn't so difficult and so angry. Well, here's John Boyega doing absolutely everything that a Telegraph or a Daily Mail columnist would wish the black community would do, and much good it does him.
Yes.
You know, much good it does him. He's treated no better than these guys who are being walloped with rifle butts and threatened with death.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely heartbreaking because I think it's a fantastic piece of filmmaking because as a white person, you are able to feel what it's like, some tinge of what it must be like to be at the wrong end of that kind of, you know, completely unmediated, uncontrolled kind of tyranny, really.
Yeah. He puts you sort of right in there. He's not cheeky to the others. He doesn't sort of answer back. He doesn't sort of attempt to take sides during the sort of conflict. Or if he does, he's sort of closer to the cop side than the victim side. But Yeah, at the end of it, he's still on the sort of, he's still effectively on the receiving end.
Have you seen any of her other stuff? Have you seen Zero Dark 30?
Yeah, I have. I rewatched Zero Dark 30 last night, which I'm not crazy about. I think it's sort of, I think it's overlong, and the build up to it is kind of, is interesting, but I didn't feel as a thriller it worked as well as it did, and then the sort of the final climactic scene is kind of a little bit of a letdown, if only because so much of it happens in the damn dark, and it's sort of it's very hard to sort of really get much sort of that kind of like visceral impact of the cinematic experience that you get with Detroit right from the very start.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about her stuff is I mean, she's seems to be very interested in just like the kinetics of cinema, the Hurt Locker in particular.
The Hurt Locker is a great film and is much closer, I think, in sort of spirit to Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, in the Hurt Locker, she has this kind of almost kind of poetic fascination with what happens in an explosion. She concentrates on it. And the interesting thing for me with Detroit is that the way it's cut and edited is incredibly impressionistic. There's a few widescreen shots of riots happening in the street, but mostly it's composed of impressions and little glances. In a way that if you were trapped in a melee, you'll never see the big picture, but you might see a shadowy figure under a streetlight, or you might see a police car going past you, or a flying bottle. And I found it really immersive like that. I thought it was quite impressive in that respect. Let's talk about the performances. Will Poulter, I'm never going to think of him as sort of Rambo ever again. That cute, lovable little kid. This is one of the great modern movie monsters. He is... You know, it's Lord of the Flies. I mean, if it's possible to even abstract it from a race question, this is what happens when people are in the land of do as you please, when there is no sanction against them. And it's truly horrifying, isn't it?
Well, Son of Rambo is the last thing I saw him in. I know he's done a few sort of fantasy things since then.
He's got a good face for fantasy. He's got an unusual face,
But he's got a sort of slightly... He has a slightly surprisingly mannish voice for someone who still has such a sort of baby face. Really, he still looks sort of, you know, if you just sort of, took away the sort of anything above the eyes and so on, he still looks like that same kid. The same, what was his name? Lee Parker, the whatever kid, he was called in Son of Rambo. But he's a swaggering. He is a sort of proper fascist, effectively. Yeah. You sort of hear him talk when he is first. When he is in the car with his partner before the Adelphi Hotel business, and he has this encounter with the looter, and you see him sort of talking about it then, and he is very much in that sort of...
But I thought it was a fantastic fake out there, because the first things you hear him say in the cop car are, "We're failing these people." And you kind of think, well, mate, is this going to be, you know, a vaguely liberal cop?
Yeah.
But his idea of failing people is that we're not coming down hard enough on them.
Yeah, his idea, when he means they're failing them, he means they're not keeping the bad guys in line.
Yeah, but he identifies the entire black community as the bad guys. Yeah. Yes. Boyega, we've just talked about. I mean, I think it's a brilliantly restrained performance, you know, just attempting to walk the line.
Yeah.
But the other British actor who's in it is, it's Gilly from Game of Thrones, Hannah Murray, who plays one of the two white girls who happens to be in the hotel. I thought there were brilliant performances in terms of the sheer panic when these girls have been pitched into an utterly unfamiliar scenario. But there are those horrible scenes where the cops suddenly say to them, well, we're trying to protect you. We're doing this for your own good, after brutalising them, tearing their clothes off.
She literally has blood all over her face as he's saying that to her. I mean, he's similarly sort of 10 seconds earlier, virtually, he sort of gum-butted her.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's absolutely stunning. I mean, I think both of them are good, but sort of her, she obviously has the sort of slightly meatier role. I think they're very, very sort of like likeable characters. It would have been very easy to make them dumb chicks out for a good time. One for better word. They could have easily been sort of put in that, and then in a sort of typical film, I don't know, one of them would have sort of run away and they would have drifted out of the story relatively early. They wouldn't have felt like a big part of it.
Yeah.
But they were sort of given proper character, and they didn't succumb to the cops until they were sort of really beaten. They sort of continued to be cheeky. They spoke up for themselves. And, I thought she gave a stunning performance.
The actual real-life person who was involved in the Algiers Hotel that her character is based upon, she was a consultant to the movie, so which kind of gives it a certain degree of bona fide, shall we say. You raised the criticism a minute ago that the black characters just don't have any agency. Things happen to them. Isn't that what the film is about?
Yes.
That is the subject of the movie.
Yes, that's what I thought. I think that sort of seeing it through... modernised, it's seen it through sort of, you know, Black Lives Matter eyes and so on. It's this sort of feeling that the black protest story should have been bigger than the black victim story. I mean, yeah. there was sort of one particular incident which I sort of knew nothing about, which was raised by sort of one critic who sort of said the Black Panthers staged a kind of their own mock trial
yes.
of the police officers, and it was something that went on for sort of several days. And Rosa Parks apparently used to turn up, she was living in Detroit at the time.
Yeah.
And he was sort of talking about what an interesting sort of idea for a film it would have made. And I sort of think, well, yes, it possibly would. It would have been extremely interesting, especially if you're a politics professor.
Yeah.
And then you would have sort of had all this sort of clashes of sort of, you know, who has the sort of like sort of legal authority here? What does this sort of people's court, what does it amount to? But those are questions for academics.
Yeah, well,
they're not
think,
questions for movie makers.
I mean, I could see
as much.
If Detroit was going to be an 8-part Netflix series,
yes.
I could see that, you know, in the way that The Wire starts with the drugstore and spills
yes.
out to take it. But this is a 2-hour yeah. movie and it can't yeah. be about everything. I always get really concerned when people start to complain
yeah.
about the story people decided not to tell. Because
yeah.
not everything can be about everything.
No. No. And as Bigelow, as you say, she's particularly good at that immersive stuff. She puts you in the place. And the question is not, you know, why did events unfold the way that they did, so much as like sort of, what would you have done in that position? How would you have reacted? I don't really think she could have done that aspect of it any
yeah.
better.
Well, the disturbing thing is it puts you both in the position of these black characters who are on their, literally on their
yeah.
knees with a gun pointed at their head. But also, you kind of see in the way the white characters behave, because it's, you know, at the centre there's Poulter who's out of control, but there's an awful lot of turning of a blind eye from the National Guard, from other cops.
Mm. From the state police
yeah,
who just turn up and go, I don't want to get involved in a civil rights issue.
Yeah, and you find yourself thinking...
In the middle of a race riot.
Yeah, and you find yourself thinking, well, if I was that guy, would I have stepped forward and said, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Sergeant, you can't possibly continue like this.
Yeah.
It's really uncomfortable stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the criticisms, another of the criticisms that's put to it is that there are flashes of good cop in here. You know, we do see, you know, one cop say, I can't believe someone would beat somebody so badly. What's happened to you? And to me, that feels a little bit tokenistic, a little bit kind of, you know, to try and balance it a little bit, possibly in an artificial manner. I don't know. What did you think?
Possibly. I wouldn't want to judge. It's sort of, it's very hard to sort of say that you can't have a sort of character like that, because, you know, sort of after all, the police did sort of effectively try and prosecute them. And
yeah.
I would assume we can only sort of take... I haven't sort of looked deeply into the case, but the Poulter sergeant was furious with him. He was furious with him after the first case. He sent him back out.
Yeah.
It was clearly, he decided, given the circumstances and the riot that was going on, it was better to have a dirty cop than no cop out there.
Yeah.
You know, he was absolutely sort of livid with him. And
yeah.
he did sort of force through, you know, he sort of, it was him who sort of brought the prosecution. He got the confessions, he brought through the prosecutions, or sort of recommended for prosecution. I can only assume that that is what happened. So
yeah.
I wouldn't want to sort of suggest something like that was a tokenistic thing.
Is this an enjoyable movie? Can you watch this for entertainment? I mean, because
it's an impactful movie.
Yeah.
I wasn't bored. I can say that much.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
It wasn't one of those where you're sort of checking the watch. it's definitely a movie you should see.
Yeah.
You know, I think your life will be poorer without it. Enjoyable, who knows?
Yeah. I thought it was a fantastic movie making experience
yeah.
and a cinema experience, and I was absolutely, you know, pinned to my seat.
Yeah.
And you know, in the massive old cliche, it does stay with you. So it's out this weekend. Detroit is in cinemas this weekend. Go and see it, but prepare yourself.
We've got an extra special additional thing for you on Big Mouth this week. We have a special side podcast in which we are talking to the legendary brother duo Sparks, Ron and Russell Mayle, around their new album Hippopotamus. Just to give you a little bit of a taster for it, here is Ron discussing rock and roll brothers and why they fight and how the Sparks brothers don't.
It's an odd thing that there's seems to be like for so much animosity between the Gallagher, you know, you kind of can't understand how that even exists. So for us, it's kind of natural the other way. So,
what's the worst thing you've ever fallen out about?
Well, there's nothing musically on a grand scale that we have, you know, major debate. There's like more specific little things, but the grand scheme and the grand thrust of what Sparks wants to be doing, we kind of see eye to eye, and there's not, we kind of have this unspoken mission statement that we kind of adhere to, and we both, you know, subscribe to that, and so there aren't those kinds of conflicts that seem to be prevailing with, you know, other brother acts, and I don't know why.
Okay, let's crack on with some music. Each week we ask our guests to bring in a tune that they're enjoying right now, their own personal editor's recommendation. Steve Yates, what have you brought in for us?
A new track by Caitlin Aurelia Smith. She's just about to release her, I believe, third album. She's a kind of, she's a sort of American egghead producer. She used to live in this sort of place called Orcas Island up in Washington State. She now lives in LA, sort of almost inevitably. But she sort of makes virtually all her stuff on sort of old Buchla synthesizers.
I haven't even heard of those ones.
Okay. She makes this sort of extraordinary kind of like watery electronica, which doesn't really sort of sound like anything else. The new album, which I've heard all of, is different in as much as it's sort of much more heavily vocal. And it sort of comes across a little somewhere between The Knife and perhaps Matthew Herbert's stuff when he was doing things like Bodily Functions, when Matthew Herbert was making good sing-along proper tunes.
Yeah.
And it's sort of somewhere around there, but sort of still distinctly her own aesthetic.
Well, let's have a listen then. This is Caitlin Aurelia Smith and To Follow and Lead. Caitlin Aurelia Smith with To Follow and Lead, as chosen by Steve Yates. Nothing like a bit of spacey, African, Scottish dancing, watery electronica to get you going in the day. Let's have a little bit more music. Ghost Poet, a.k.a. Obaro Ejimwe, I hope I said that right, was nominated for the Mercury Prize on his second and third albums. He's developed a hypnotic and very personal mix of talking blues-style hip-hop in the tricky vein, with strange additions like guitars and actual singing and string quartets and so forth. His new fourth album, Dark Days and Canapes, is out now. We're going to talk about it in a minute after this track. This is called Immigrant Boogie. That was Ghost Poet and Immigrant Boogie from his new album Dark Days and Canapes. Steve Yates, daft question, but is this even hip-hop anymore?
No, not really. It was, I think when he sort of first started out, there was sort of definite, a much stronger element of hip-hop. It was sort of coming, musically, it was sort of coming through that kind of, what I guess was then being called post-dubstep, but it still sort of felt very much like a sort of a rapper's or a rapper/poet's take on hip-hop. I think he's sort of rather left that behind, and it now feels like a sort of spoken word electronica meets almost alt-rock in places.
Yeah, because it does come in at the kind of Mogwai Radiohead end of abstract rock sometimes, doesn't it?
I read one review this weekend which sort of compared it to the OK Computer and found it rather wanting compared to OK Computer, which I thought was...
Why would you even...
A little bit harsh.
It's a bit of an obvious thing to say, isn't it? Once your guitar's on, you've got to be compared to OK Computer. What did you make of it yourself?
He's one of those artists I sort of find quite hard to love these days. I think when the first one came out, sort of Peanut Butter, whatever it's called, I thought it was sort of strikingly different. I preferred the beats there, and that was one that I sort of did play quite a lot. His vocals, they've always been a sort of like sort of monotone and so on, and rather sort of dispassionate.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of sometimes does take something away from the weight of the words. It means that you're not necessarily listening to them as much as maybe you could do, given that he sort of talks about some sort of relatively weighty stuff. When you see them written down, there's some quite impressive stuff going on, but I don't think it necessarily gets conveyed all that well.
I quite like that monotone. I mean, I have my kind of hackles, not hackles rise, but I think there's a lot there was around the kind of the time that his first record came out and maybe a little bit before. There's always been that kind of alternative spoken word hip hop thing going on in the UK, and I kind of feel that the Mercury nominations were because you could kind of play it at a dinner party. I think this is a lot more. I find this more interesting than his earlier stuff, actually.
Right.
I think there's a real massive Attack vibe going on in it, and yeah. Not only because Daddy G turns up on one track and kind of. It's difficult to say whether Grant ever phones in a performance yeah. because he's very, you know, he's very. Yeah. But there is what
like
the
last.
I think the final line he actually on his kind of verse, he actually kind of runs out of syllables and just kind of stretches the ones that he's got out to meet the end of the line, the end yeah. of the beat. But I thought, I kind of, you know, I thought the Immigrant Boogie, which we just heard, is really good, and the yeah. Woe Is Me track with Grant on it, and Dopamine If I Do, you know, that. When it's kind of drifty, it is drifty, and finds it very easy to drift out of your kind of attention. But when there's a bit more going on, I found it quite yeah.
Well, the key thing here is it is lots of live band in here, including, you know, string quartets, and one of the guys from Shame is involved, and you know, it's actual, you know, this is a band performing. I mean, the subjects are depression, overwork, the cruelty of the world, the refugee crisis, psychological collapse, and yet for all that, I actually found it quite uplifting and enjoyable. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of, I mean, there are certain tracks. Trouble in Me is a straight up sad indie pop tune,
yeah.
And yet for all that, I kind of, to me, this is like, it's obviously clearly in the Tricky vein. To an extent, it's like if Tricky hadn't taken that mad swerve into industrial lunacy. And
yeah,
gone
I think
America.
It's also, there's also a very Roots Maneuver kind of
yes.
Vibe going yes. on in there. I mean, also in his cadence and in his kind of patterns, vocal patterns. That
I think Rodney is much more distinctive, much more definitely a rapper.
Yeah.
Rather than sort of
but in terms of closer to kind of the accent.
Yeah, I mean, Roots Maneuver is definitely, here is my wordplay, isn't it good? And it is really good.
Yeah.
This is much more impressionistic. It's kind of yeah. like, it's ambient rap. Oh, it's trip. Oh, it's trip hop. The return of trip hop.
Who invented that?
I don't know.
Was that us?
Possibly so, yeah. I mean, I do think there are some really good jokes in it as well. You mentioned that track called Dopamine If I Do, and I thought that the title of the album itself, you know, Dog Days and Cannibals, is highly amusing. The tune of Dopamine If I Do, to me, sounds like Stereolab or St. Etienne. So, I mean, he's clearly got broad listening patterns.
Yeah, I surprisingly for me, some of the stuff that I liked most on it were the things with the easiest, most sort of obvious rock references. Freak yeah. Show, which sort of sounds, it could be the Susie and the Banshees. That's sort of
exactly that's what, yeah.
And then there's another one which has got that sort of chiming Cocteau's
yeah.
sort of thing. I found those sort of like really, really interesting. And I could quite happily, aesthetically at least, I could quite happily have heard an album a bit like that.
Yeah.
Once you sort of get into that, you are very definitely into that sort of alt-rap territory, and that brings a whole load of baggage with it that he may have yeah. found uncomfortable, so I can see why he wouldn't have wanted to make a whole album like that. But
I thought those... rap, you know, pearly dewdrop hip-hops. I'll be all over that.
Yeah. Not a bad idea.
Get Robin Guthrie on the phone. Yeah.
It's an excellent idea. Where yeah. does he live now? France?
Probably, yeah. Well, there was one particular track that stuck out to me, Many Moons at Midnight. It sounded to me like it was based on Hans Zimmer's Inception soundtrack. It had all those kind of, had that kind of revolving chord sequence. I think he's clearly a really, you know, broad listening chappy with a lot yeah. of interest. It's not all just like, you know, I'm doing it on a laptop kind of thing. And you're absolutely right to spot Susie and the Banshees. He seems like a really likeable bloke as
oh,
well.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of, you know, yeah. mum and dad ran a cab business and an estate agent in Tooting.
No, I saw him when his first album came out up at the that small venue in Islington, I forget, Electric Works or something, is it called?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was sort of doing stuff with a sort of small live band even then. So he's very much not the sort of typical, you know, sort of sampler and a laptop kind of vibe at all.
Yeah.
That's never been his thing. It's got a much more sort of fluid and sort of improvised feel to it. What
yeah.
it does, yeah.
yeah.
So yeah, it's a good record. It whether it sort of pushes him over into sort of brand new places, you know, will be interesting to see.
Well, he'll be waiting on his third Mercury nomination. Third time's lucky, kind of thing. Like doing the
third
playoffs
time's
every
the charm.
Year. Yeah. He's in the Mercury playoffs every single
maybe
year.
Maybe he'll sort of never win one, and then he really will be like Radiohead.
Yeah, that could be it, yeah. Well, Dark Days and Canapes by Ghost Poet is out now. So let's move on to our final topic. Netflix have put four key Marvel characters on the small screen over the past couple of years. Now, the blind lawyer superhero Daredevil, the semi-alcoholic abuse survivor Jessica Jones, the unfairly imprisoned Harlem hero Luke Cage and Kung Fu Rich Kid Danny Iron Fist Rand all come together in one 8-part series as The Defenders. It's fair to say that their individual shows have been of varying quality, from the top-notch psychological drama of Jessica Jones and the first Daredevil series to the flatly tedious Iron Fist. So where will The Defenders end up on the Marvel scale? We're going to talk about it after this. This is from the soundtrack. This is Mos Def and Sunshine.
Yeah, it's a brand new day, y'all. turn me up on the top a little bit, dawg. I want them to know. I want them to hear this one. Loud and clear. Bright and early. Listen.
That was Most Deaf and Sunshine. Now, Steve Yates, we all know that Jurgen Klopp is badly in need of quality defenders, but what about the rest of us? Are we in need of the defenders?
Oh, dear. This is, to quote Slick Rick, I think this is the moment I feared was that I'd be sort of come doing this podcast and be thrown into sort of talking about a comic book thing.
It's not your thing,
and in particular, a comic book thing where you already have this sort of large group of disparate and well-established characters, each with their own sort of probably very complicated backstory, and a plot which, if it does emerge, emerges rather sort of slowly. And
yeah, it's got very much the Netflix thing of the story starts in episode 3.
Yeah, which is absolutely fine if you're sort of, you know, you feel kind of like engaged with the characters from the off, which, with one or two exceptions, I have to say, sort of did not. I mean, there were some, you know, there are some upsides. It's beautifully shot in New York, and New York always looks fantastic. I can sort of watch it almost for that alone. Some of the characters work for me more easily than others. So, you know, Jessica Jones being one, Luke Cage is a sort of very welcome and rather sort of familiar anchor.
Yeah.
But some of the others, and it was nice to see Sigourney Weaver, but I have to say, I did not have a faintest idea what she was doing there.
Fair enough. Matt, now, Matt, you're more familiar. Like me, you're a massive comic. You know who Power Man and Iron Fist were in Heroes for Hire and all that stuff. How did you take to the Defenders?
I really like the idea of, I mean, when I was a kid, the kind of comics that I liked, the kind of comic heroes that I liked, were the guys who didn't have that many special powers and weren't off fighting aliens and saving the universe, but were...
You liked League One rather than Premiership superheroes.
Yeah, you know, like Spider-Man and Daredevil. They were kind of dealing with kind of, you know, people who could turn their fists into big lumps of sand and break into banks and stuff, which is all great. It was all brilliant. And so I quite like the Defenders, and I have watched all of the various Marvel, the prequels to this, which weren't prequels, they were standalones. Mm-hmm. I think that it was interesting that they did it in 8 parts.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the new thing that you know, you get with Game of Thrones and stuff. And whether that was because Netflix weren't sure that it would last over a longer series. I take Steve's point about it being a very slow burn build. That's happened on all of the Marvel series that they've done. It takes until the third episode until people either discover their powers or figure out what they're supposed to be doing, and in this one, until they actually kind of come together.
Well, the setup is essentially you've got these four heroes, and they're all kind of following their own trails, which bring them together.
Yeah.
It's going to bring them together as the kind of, you know, like local cost cutter Avengers Justice League kind of thing.
Pound Shop JLA.
Pound Shop JLA, absolutely, yeah. I believe he's also guesting with Ghost Poet later. And, you know, you see the traditional thing, you know, the heroes fight and then they become best pals. I particularly enjoyed Iron Fist versus Luke Cage because, as an old nerd, I know that they're actually the best mates. In real life, meaning the comics, in real life, they're best mates. Yeah. In this version, they hate each other. What I liked about it is because you've got these four different stories and each one of these characters has done a different... They represent a different take on New York. So you've kind of got four different perspectives. You've got Luke Cage in Harlem. You've got Mac Murdock, who is Daredevil in Hell's Kitchen, Midtown. He's a lawyer, so he's encountering all kinds of different... The halt and the lame and the poor and the disadvantaged. Iron Fist, to me, is the least compelling character because he's basically a rich kid on a kung fu quest.
Oh, that's who Iron Fist is. And, he lost me completely, I have to say.
And Jessica Jones is this kind of mentally traumatised, alcoholic, but basically very charismatic individual. What I found problematic about it, difficult about it rather, is that each of their individual series has its own tone. Like, the Daredevil series is immensely noir and it's basically a mob crime drama. Luke Cage's blaxploitation, Jessica Jones's psychological drama, Iron Fist is kind of very shallow kung fu. And they
although I do kind of like that, there's a bit in one of the episodes, and if I sound a bit strung out, it's because I stayed up until kind of way too late last night watching the whole series. There's a bit in one of the episodes where they do that classic kung fu trope where he's kind of in a room and five guys come to take him on one after the other. They like line up and it's just brilliant, you know.
Well, it's very easy to solve that in the world of kung fu. You just need somebody somewhere in a movie to say, why do you guys always attack one at a time? And all you need is the sensei to say, to do it otherwise would be dishonourable. And that's a problem solved, you know, but that's why they attack one at a time. What I thought, though, is that it's not just that their parts of, you know, their areas of New York are different. It's that the tone of each show is different. Yeah. And I think Jessica Jones is one of the best products of the whole Marvel superhero boom, because it's got psychological depth, as has Daredevil. Iron Fist has none. And it's like bringing together different fictional worlds. It's like trying to put... It's like having the TARDIS materialise in The Wire. It just wouldn't fit. It's like having the 18 turn up in the middle of Breaking Bad. It would not fit. That's my problem.
But that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way, that you just described it about different sections and different kind of populations of New York being represented by the different individuals. But it kind of does come together in the end. And like you kind of, the thing that kind of disappoints me still is that... Iron Fist isn't wearing a yellow face mask and a bright green V-neck jumpsuit. You know,
you want him to look like one of Earth, Wind and Fire, don't you? Also, where is Luke Cage getting all of his hoodies and his yellow T-shirts from? Because he goes through about 10 an episode.
He's got a deal with Carhartt, quite obviously.
Yeah, quite right, yes.
I thought that there's a couple of... I was looking at some of the kind of reviews online yesterday. There was a couple of kind of quite... There's a couple of quite savage ones, but it's got a general kind of, hey, this is an okay thing. I don't think it's going to kind of... It's slightly confusing in that if you start from... If you haven't done the other five,
if you're poor
six
old
series,
Steve and you've had to start from
scratch, then it's kind of like you're being... it's a little bit like the exposition at the start is not great. You don't understand why Matt Murdock is no longer Daredevil at the start, is kind of put the Daredevil character into retirement, and you don't understand why Luke Cage is just getting out of prison, though that is a very funny scene because it's the classic walking down the cell block and all the kind of other prisoners banging on the walls, and then they can't find the key for the handcuffs, so he just snaps them. And the kind of prison guard looks at him like, oh shit,
why didn't you do that before?
He could have done that
That's great. He just demonstrates why he's a stand up guy. The supporting cast is great. You know, you've got the cast of Daredevil, Foggy Nelson and Karen Page. You've got Rosario Dawson's brilliant. You know, Carrie Ann Moss's. You've got loads of brilliant walk-ons. To me, it's like the Daredevil story. Basically, the story of Daredevil is about his addiction to violence and his guilt about it, because he's a Catholic and he's never out of the confession box. Forgive me, Father, I went and battered the kingpin again the other night. Oh, you know, that's all right, my son. The Lord works in mysterious ways. His story is about his addiction to violence. Jessica Jones's story is about she's essentially an abuse survivor. And
PTSD,
She's cut herself off from society. You know... the Luke Cage story is about it's the age old story of a good man trying to make it in a bad world, and to me, Iron Fist is the weak link, because who really cares about a rich kid?
The other thing that's that was really disappointing about this series is Sigourney Weaver, who is great and can kind of just charisma and can act anybody off the screen. This is a spoiler, for which I apologise. So if you don't want to hear it, turn off now. All the way through, there is discussions and allusions to what a brilliant fighter she is.
Yeah.
And all the way through, I was waiting for her to pull a Ripley and kind of, you know, go chop socky on somebody's ass. It doesn't happen.
Right.
And that is, you know, what's the point of getting one of the best action actors, never mind female action actors, in a series as the head of a kind of massive great crime organization, and then not letting her do what she does.
Yeah, but you know, real bad boys walk in silence, don't they?
Yeah, but she keeps on saying all the way through the series, it's kind of like, you don't want to go against me. Remember last time you did it, and keeping all that, you know.
Well, that's fair enough. I mean, what I was more concerned with, I'm sorry to bang on about Iron Fist, but he's such a drip. Iron Fist's sidekick, Colleen Wing, is brilliant.
Yeah.
She's an interesting character. She's driven. She's got ideas. She's independent. And she's sitting on the bench while you know, junior kind of trust fund boy spends there with his Iron Fist. I thought she should have been in it more. On the upside, at least the actress who plays Elektra isn't speaking this time very much, because she's so terrible in the last series of Daredevil. So where do we think it's going to... I mean, obviously, Steve, you haven't watched this stuff, so, you know, your take is welcome.
Where does it fit? It fits into, along with all those other Marvel things that I'll quite happily
not watch,
leave to the people who know what they're about.
So I'm going
to
ask Matt, where does it fit?
You mean in terms of...
Yeah, in the league, because obviously...
In our 10-year-old boy universe grading it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Final league table.
Of Marvel on telly, where does it fit?
I think it probably fits. I mean, I didn't mind the Iron Fist series so much, because I spent a lot of time watching really badly acted kung fu films in the mid-90s, so I've got a slightly inured to it. I would say that it is below. It's probably fourth. So below, I'm not sure whether Daredevil or Series 1 or Jessica Jones goes into the 1 or 2 slot. Then Luke Cage, because that was just shits and giggles.
Yeah.
And probably then Defenders, just because it's a team-up mag, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but I'm afraid I've got news for you, which is there's a new straight in at number 1, which I've only just discovered.
I know what you're going to say.
Which is Legion.
Oh, no.
Legion is incredible. I missed this because it was on the Fox channel. Who's got FX? Nobody's got FX. No. You need a team of Huskies to find it.
Brought out of the wire back in the day.
Yeah.
And it's done bugger all since.
Yeah. Legion is incredible. It's set in the X-Men universe, but the whole point of it, you've got a kind of psychologically fractured individual who thinks he's got these mutant powers, but he may not. He's in a mental hospital and they're treating him, or are they? Is it really a mental hospital or is it something else? The real USP of it is that it is shot like the most ridiculously over-the-top episode of The Avengers. It's like a psychedelic 1967 spy movie. Everything is beautifully art-directed. Everything's on a fisheye lens. Everything is a dream sequence or a flashback or a flash-forward. Everything is a trip sequence. There's a character called Sid Barrett, right? And this is just the most fantastic show, Legion. It's still available on demand if you've got Sky. And, you know, I love Daredevil Season 1. I love Jessica Jones, but I think it's gone in at number 1 on my Marvel chart.
I might have to try that, but I've got another. So what I thought you were going to say was the upcoming second series of Jessica Jones, which hasn't got an air date yet,
right,
but which does star David Tennant again.
But he's dead.
Yeah. I think we all know that people
No.
The Purple Man is back.
What ought to be, I think you need rules in this world, and if you're going to do street-level superheroes, dead's got to mean dead.
Mm.
And it's bad that they resurrected Elektra.
Surely they can break the rules with Doctor Who.
No, he's dead because, look, I've already spoiled the first season of Jessica Jones there. I'm against that. Anyway, never mind. Time keeps on ticking away, which means it's time for Closing Time Chatter, where our guest and Matt tell us what has been obsessing them this week. Steve, what have you got?
I've just found out there's going to be a series called Babylon Berlin coming to Sky in, I think, October, based on a series of books from a German thriller writer called Volker Kutscher. And although I've never heard of Kutscher or read any of these books, it seems like they follow quite a similar line to a series of books which I absolutely love by Philip Kerr, the Bernie Gunther books, which are basically answer the question, what would happen if you put Rayburn Chandler's Marlowe into Nazi Germany? Mm. Now, I think this asks the question, what would happen if you put Philip Marlowe into Weimar Germany?
Right. So basically, you've had enough of alt-right Nazis. It's the campaign for real Nazis.
The campaign for
real
Nazis.
Proper Nazis, yeah.
And we've had some god-awful Nazis. I mean, I didn't really sort of enjoy The Man in the High Castle. I could see that it was sort of quite well done, but I found it unfathomable. And SSGB was
boring, wasn't it? It was
boring as hell. I mean, it seemed to be on sort of mission to make Nazis as boring as possible. I don't really know how you can do that. You sort of start off with the basic premise, you know, there's some counterfactual, fascinating counterfactual. What would have happened if the Nazis had won the war? What would have happened in Britain?
Yeah.
And you then
there is the banality of evil, but you don't want to be watched banality, do you? You want it to be watchable.
So I'm hoping this one will sort of play it slightly straighter and come up with something that is compelling. And I'm also hoping that maybe with this, someone will get the bright idea of finally dramatising the Bernie Gunther books, because it's long overdue.
So Babylon Berlin is starting on Sky Atlantic in October, apparently. Babylon Berlin, can't you see? Babylon Berlin with anxiety. Matt Hall, what have you got for your Closing Time Chatter?
There's a series of videos put out by NPR. There's a NPR show called All Songs Considered, which is a very kind of presented by a guy called Bob Bolan, which is a really nice, but it's a really good podcast, and they kind of range far and wide over the musical landscape. They do this for the last few years. They've been doing these video concerts called the Tiny Desk Concerts, and the idea is they actually kind of set up artists in a corner of the NPR music office, so it's kind of got shelves and all this kind of other stuff behind it. And normally it's, yeah, it's lovely. It's kind of, this is the kit, and it's kind of like piece of people with acoustic guitars and Laura Marling and stuff. The one that they've just put out is brilliant for a number of reasons. One, it's DJ Premier and his, who formerly of Gangstar and legendary hip-hop producer and DJ. And he's got a live outfit, which I didn't know of, and they've been apparently touring in Europe, called the Badder Band. And there's basically a drummer and a bass player and a couple of horn players. And what they do is they play the riffs over Premier's kind of scratching and playing of records. And it's just really great. It's a half-hour long video, and all of the kind of classic hip-hop's building blocks are present and correct, and they plays kind of Still Number One from BDP, and plays Half and Half from MOP, and he plays Das Effects, and he plays loads of different stuff. But to watch a bloke in his 50s having so much fun.
Sounds like the show.
Behind a pair of decks. It's just an excuse, basically, for him to go out and shout out himself and all his mates, and it's just a great listen and a great watch.
Will you put this on the Facebook page?
I will certainly do that.
And
yeah,
if the viewers can't find the Facebook page, where can they find this?
It's, well, it's on, so it's a Tiny Desk concert. I watched it on a website which I spend way too much time on, called Ambrosia for Heads.
Is that a special tin dessert for hip hop guys?
It's AFH.
AFH, right? Okay. Well, my closing time chat is we've been banging on about comics. In fact, we've done comics, hip hop, and Nazis. So it's like almost the prototypical episode of Big Mouth. I'm going to bang on about a comics thing. I just want to plug Comixology, which is the fantastic app for the phone and the iPad where you get digital comics. And the reason I want to plug it this week is there is a sale on for the writer Brian K. Vaughan, and he writes two absolutely fantastic series at the moment. One is called Saga. It is the best space opera you will ever read. It's basically Romeo and Juliet in outer space. You know, he's from the magic planet, she's from the technology planet. Everybody hates them. They've got a kid, you know, and the universe is out to kill them. You can get basically the first and second omnibuses, which usually retail for £28 each. They're £9 each on Comixology. They're practically giving this stuff away. And his other series is called Paper Girls, which is effectively kind of came out the same time as Stranger Things, and it's the same stuff. It's chopper bikes in suburbia meets very, very strange science fiction, psycho horror. Beautifully drawn by Cliff Chang, some of the most beautiful art you'll ever see. Also, Saga is beautifully drawn as well. But, you know, these are just incredible artifacts to own. And they're doing the Paper Girls books at like £2.50 instead of £9. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So I suggest very strongly that you go to comixology.co.uk and look at their Brian K. Vaughan sale, because it will change your life. And I was not paid to say this. So that's enough comics, hip hop, and Nazis for one week. That's the end of another show. Thanks to Steve Yates for joining us.
My pleasure.
Please come in again. Listeners, remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. You can subscribe via Apple Podcasts, either on your app, on your phone, or in the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store. And you can also find us on Spotify. Follow us on Twitter at @big_mouth_UK if you fancy it, and we'll keep you up to date with everything we're doing. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again next week.